The Tom Woods Show, episode 2044.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Scott Horton is back with us today for the first time in quite a while. Probably, Scott, for the first time since after your debate with Bill Kristol that was such a smashing success, not only for you, but also really for all of us and for the Libertarian Institute. So before I'm screwing up the whole intro because I should give people your background. Most people know Scott Horton by now, which I can tell from the fact that at my 2000th episode event, it was almost a riot. People were so excited to see him. He was a surprise guest. The people went absolutely berserk when Scott came out. Scott, of course, has done, I guess, over, if I'm remembering this right, must be well over 5,500 interviews by now. He is the host of the Scott Horton Show. He is, what's your role at the Libertarian Institute, Scott?
I'm the director.
Director of the Libertarian Institute, which you can check out.
I'm proud to say you are too, only a different kind, but on my board.
On your board, that's right. Libertarianinstitute.org, editorial director, antiwar.com. You still do anti-war radio?
Yes, sir. Sunday mornings at 8:30 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
All right.
But I'm an Austinite, so don't anybody get that mixed up.
Yeah, no. I think you gave L.A. a try back when it was more tolerable than it is now and decided Austin was really where your heart was. So, all right, well, what I want to talk about today, and I have to say, by the way, I probably would have been too much of a doofus to do this episode had it not been for the prodding of a listener whom I know personally who emailed and said, I cannot believe you have not done a single episode on the status of U.S.-Russian relations, particularly in light of the negotiations going on right now. And I thought, sheesh, you know, you're right. And I think what's happened in my case, Scott, I think I'm not alone in this. I think right now, because the domestic front has so occupied our attention, I think a lot of people feel like foreign policy, you know, yeah, we know they'll screw that up, but we can afford to pay more attention to what's going on domestically. But there's a real powder keg potentially here. And so I think we do need to be looking at it and talking about it. So there are two things we probably want to get to over the course of the conversation. Of course, negotiations involving primarily Ukraine. But then also we have to talk about what's happening in Kazakhstan. And the thing is, you even say Kazakhstan and people think, oh, I'm never going to know and understand what that's all about. I'm sure the U.S. is in the wrong, but I just don't have time to figure it out. Well, today's your lucky day because you will know what's going on, thanks to Scott Horton. So talk about, first of all, what is the agenda? It seems like there was even a dispute about what it should be.
Yeah. Well, so the talks, I think, are over for now. As we're recording this on Thursday morning, I believe they wrapped up these talks yesterday without any real firm conclusions, but they both said positive things at the end that they're open to having more talks and this and that. And they floated essentially the American position. Well, first of all, the Russian position is they want a promise. They essentially want America to rescind its invitation to Ukraine and Georgia that W. Bush made in 2008. To invite them into NATO eventually. And the Americans, of course, are saying nobody shuts the door on NATO membership. But of course, that's just the way they're phrasing it. They could be the ones shutting the door on it, and that would be just fine. Anyway, we'll get back to that. And then he also wants the Americans to stop putting more weapons. And in fact, I think he even was pretty maximalist demand, pull all American weapons and bases and troops and equipment out of the former Soviet states or Warsaw Pact states that have joined NATO in the last 30 years, which obviously they're not going to go for that. But that's the severity of the demands here. And he also wants a promise that they're not going to try to bring any of the stands into NATO as well. Now, here's the thing that is one of the major demands that I have to say, I don't know why exactly they brought this up, Tom. I don't know of any, you know, I might have missed it, but I haven't heard anything about the Americans talking about putting anti-ballistic missiles in Ukraine the way they have done in Poland. But this is one of Putin's demands. You know, they've been flowing in anti-tank missiles and trucks and rifles and this kind of thing for the last few years since Trump, and Biden has continued that. But the thing is, if they put in anti-ballistic missiles, those are launched from the MK-41 missile launchers And those are a dual-use technology and can also be used to launch Tomahawk cruise missiles tipped with H-bombs. And so this is the same problem that they have with the same launchers on our ships in the Baltic Sea, where they're reducing warning time of a possible nuclear strike on Moscow, you know, from 30 minutes to maybe even as short as 5 or 10 or something like that. And basically, in other words, in case of even a false alarm, we're giving the Russians very little time to figure out what's going on and using launchers provocatively that could be used for offensive weapons. So those are Putin's demands, and he started building up troops. Now, the way the Washington Post put it was he built up 175,000-man-strong invasion force right on Ukraine's border. And they started pushing that at the beginning of November, but that just wasn't true. But they were about 200 kilometers from the border, which is still something, but it was never as many as 175,000. It was lower than 100,000, I believe. And then on Christmas, they announced that they were pulling 10,000 out, which was, you know, a symbol of de-escalation. Ray McGovern made a big deal, I think correctly, about how the Times and the Post refused to cover this. The New York Post covered it, but the Washington Post and the New York Times refused to touch it because, as Ray put it, it was Christmas and all their CIA officers were at home and not there to tell them how to portray it. And they didn't have their narrative, so they just didn't cover it at all. It's humiliating for them, I think, you know, for those of us paying attention. They're building up this narrative that, oh, Russia's about to invade Ukraine. But then how's that consistent with they just pulled 10,000 men away from this supposed invasion force, which was obviously a signal, right? That, look, we're trying to ramp this thing down. If you guys will join us in the ramping down here, right? Now, here's the thing. In the talks, they said, you know what? We can probably reach an agreement about these missiles. And in fact, on December the 30th, Biden said that we're not putting those kind of missiles into Ukraine. So I don't know if they were planning on that or if at least they had been considering that. Maybe the Russians had some intelligence that said that they were really planning on that. Or maybe that was just a wild guess and something that Putin was saying, you better not even think about doing that. But apparently Biden doesn't have any intention, as far as I can tell, in putting those type of missile launchers into Ukraine anyway. So there's one big point of agreement that both sides can, you know, shake hands on and start to work toward a real agreement on. But then also Biden, I think, Tom, this was also on December the 30th. I'd have to go back and check. I'm sorry. But he did say, no, we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO, not anytime in the next 10 years, which is, of course, longer than his term of office, assuming he's reelected, which is, you know, stand in for indefinitely, essentially. You know, France and Germany really did the heavy lifting on keeping Ukraine out back during the W. Bush and Obama years. Those politics can change. Angela Merkel is gone and Holland is gone from France. So, you know, I don't know everything about the new leadership there, but they may be much more compliant with American goals, as far as I know. That's the worry.
But when you say American goals, if Biden says we're not going to do it for 10 years, do you feel like that's stable?
That's right. I mean, if Biden really agrees that he doesn't want to do it either, then that'd be fine. But, you know, the problem is there's so many hawks. I mean, the American foreign policy blob, as Obama's man, Ben Rhodes, called them, the, you know, national security establishment, they are such hawks. There is just always so much pressure on the president to do more and more and more always, no matter who the president is. And, you know, Biden's pretty old and weak as a leader.
Right. So that guarantee doesn't necessarily mean what he might want it to mean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he, as we saw with Afghanistan, if he puts his foot down and says, I'm the president and I say so, they have to do what he says. But if he doesn't put his foot down so hard, they can kind of just end run around him and do what they want. And a lot of times I think they do. And the consensus, they're always working hard on building the consensus, is always to quote unquote the right, but, you know, the more hawkish side of whatever the president's position is.
Can we dumb this down for a minute, though, and ask,
sure,
could we make an analogy like this, that suppose during the Cold War, the Soviet Union had been considering bringing Canada into the Warsaw Pact? This would be considered absurdly provocative. Like, why would you even think about doing that? But if I were to make that analogy, I know that there are, maybe we can call them CIA libertarians. I mean, you know the sort of people I'm talking about, who are always finding some place to in the world to complain about. They would say that analogy doesn't really hold because the United States wasn't threatening to invade Canada, whereas the Russians seem constantly ready to go into Ukraine. So for the sake of world peace, we do need to do this, because if Ukraine's part of NATO, then maybe Russia will think twice.
Yeah, I mean, this is what Bob Higgs calls truncating the antecedents, right? Like if we're talking about Pearl Harbor here, the reality is that the Americans were trying to strip Russia of their relationship with Ukraine, to break up the America-Canada relationship that they already had going. That's why they ever threaten or participate in any military action there at all. In fact, I forget if we ever talked about this before, but I love to recommend to people to just search. It's really easy to find on the internet. It's Gideon Rose, who is the editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the center-left foreign policy establishment, old-line foreign policy establishment. And he did a special on the old Colbert show in February of 2014, where he explained about the coup that we were perpetrating in Kiev and using a bunch of Nazis to do this violent street putsch to overthrow the democratically elected but Russia-leaning president Yanukovych at the time. And because it's the Comedy Channel and all that, Gideon Rose is trying to make it really easy and explains that, listen, Ukraine is Russia's girlfriend. We're trying to break them up and run off with her. Ukraine is Robin to Russia's Batman. And we're trying to sever that relationship and bring Ukraine with us to the West to spite Russia, out of Russia's sphere of influence altogether. So it's just clearly the Americans who are picking this fight. And that's the analogy. If you want to do the shoe on the other foot in Canada, what if the Russians hired a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis to do a violent street putsch in Ottawa and overthrow the government there, and then launched a war on terrorism against the people of Vancouver, BC, who refused to accept the new coup junta, and then started flowing in a bunch of weapons to help the new regime fight the American-backed resistance in BC? And that's the analogy here. And of course, the answer is, if all that was happening, America would nuke Moscow. America would blow up the whole world before they let Russia become dominant in Canada. Everyone knows that that's true. America would launch a first strike H-bomb war against Russia if they even thought about it. And yet Putin, who's supposedly the most dangerous psychopath since Adolf Hitler, he's supposed to just sit there and take it. We're supposed to expect no reaction whatsoever from him. And if he does react, we're supposed to call that aggression. And here's some context. After America overthrew the government, which Joe Biden, we know for a fact, was in on that coup. Vice President Biden, our current president, was in on that coup. We know from Victoria Nuland's leaked phone call. I'm getting Vice President Biden on the conference call with the coup plotters tomorrow for an attaboy and to stick this thing together, et cetera, like that. It's right in there in the famous F the EU phone call. Again, why F the EU, Tom? Because they're taking too long to do the coup. So we're pushing them out of the way. We're going to do it ourselves. That's all she's saying there. All right.
So obviously the Russians know this about Biden.
That's right. And obviously Biden knows this about Biden too.
Well, so in other words,
it didn't begin yesterday, that they picked this fight.
But so how comforting can his assurances be, right, on all kinds of Ukraine-related matters?
Right. I mean, I think that's right. And really, I mean, the way that they put it was he held the Ukraine brief in the Obama government. So it was on him, you know? He was the leader of that policy. Obama had delegated it to him, essentially. So yeah, and that's certainly a problem.
But Scott, how do you deal with people, though, particularly in our own movement, who would listen to you and say, your a priori understanding is that the U.S. is always wrong, and that's the lens through which you look at this, whereas we are impartially looking at it, and we see this brutal authoritarian in Russia doing X, Y, and Z, but you can't see that because you're only looking to blame the American regime. I mean, you've got to have some answer to that.
Well, sure. I mean, look, the reality is the Soviet Union ceased to exist 30 years ago. America is the world empire, not Russia. Now, if you're a Latvian and you resent Russian influence in your country, because they're hardly dominant in Eastern Europe, but you resent their influence or whatever it is, I don't know what to tell you. Tough. It's not my problem. This is the United States of America over here. And you're right that there were libertarians, especially like during the Ukraine coup in 2014. This was a big fight with me and Justin from antiwar.com, Justin Raimondo, and Dan McAdams and Ron Paul and Dan Sanchez, who's now at Fee, who was at antiwar.com at the time. We had to fight this whole kind of ideological action against the libertarians who were, they were Eastern Europeans. They were from these countries and they were recruited into libertarianism by like the Atlas Society type faction of libertarianism, which is, you know, very much integrated with the State Department. I always am very skeptical when I see people in Latin American countries saying, read Mises, not Marx. And I know there's a lot of great intention there and a lot of good people there, but I'm very, very suspicious of the CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy and their efforts to infiltrate, you know, movements like that in other countries. And there are people who will say, just like before Iraq War II, they would say, listen, if you believe in liberty, you believe in liberty for everyone. And that's why we have to launch this war in Iraq. Okay. And they go, well, if you believe in liberty, Tom, then you believe in liberty for everyone. And that means that we have to support the people in Ukraine who want to be independent from Russian influence. But I just say that those things do not follow whatsoever. And again, it's American provocation. Just look at the chronology. It's not my bias. It's just the reality. That's the American provocation that led to this. In fact, to be specific, in 2013, the democratically elected pro-Russian leaning President Yanukovych was working on signing a deal with the European Union, part of a precursor step toward joining NATO too. And then he showed up at the negotiation and they told him, okay, now here's the deal. If you sign the deal with the EU, you can't sign one with Russia. And you have to sign up for, I think it was $15 billion worth of IMF loans, which just means we're stealing your wheat fields or whatever else for Archer Daniels Midland or whatever their scam was. And Yanukovych said, geez, I feel like a bride who showed up at my wedding to be greeted with a prenuptial agreement. And I kind of lost the mood. I don't think I really want to marry you anymore. And he went home. He didn't sign the deal and he went home. And meanwhile, the Russians were saying, we don't care if you have a deal with the EU. You can still have a deal with us and we'll give you some money without all these strings attached. And so Yanukovych told the Americans no. And it could be, and I don't know this, but it very well could be that they gave him an offer he couldn't possibly accept in order to generate that objection that then became the pretext for the Ukrainian right to come out into the streets and begin the Maidan protests that culminated in the coup of February of 2014. So this was all the Americans doing. And I urge people, watch the Gideon Rose interview with Colbert and listen to the F the EU phone call. You can find the original version still on YouTube. And it's Victoria Nuland is Robert Kagan's wife. She was essentially the ambassador to the EU. I forgot the exact deputy undersecretary of state for getting us into trouble over there. And she's on the phone.
That's an official position, by the way.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And she's on the phone with Jeffrey Pyatt, who is the ambassador to Ukraine. And they're plotting the coup. And they're saying, she says, Yats is the guy. That's the famous quote. Yats is the guy. That means Yatsenyuk. We want him to be the new prime minister. Well, guess who became the new prime minister 2 weeks later after the coup d'etat? Yatsenyuk. And she says, we want Klitschko on the outside for public relations. And we want Tanibok on the inside. Tanibok, is that the guy that if I put his name in Google Images, there he is with his Hitler salute in the air? The founder of the Social Nationalist Party? That Tanibok? Oh, there he is on a stage next to John McCain and Victoria Nuland in the winter of 2013 as they're, you know, generating this coup. So for those who object that history started when I say so, no, history started when I say so. I mean, it's just not right. And the fact of the matter is, to zoom out further, there's a great article in the New York Times. I mean, great as in horrible, but historical. An article by Peter Baker in the New York Times this week saying, the Russians are mad that we're not living up to a promise that we never gave. Now, Tom, for years, since the 1990s, the argument was James Baker may have promised that we would not expand NATO 1 inch east of East Germany, but they never got it in writing. And so everybody knows that a word and a handshake from the Americans is worth warm spit. So unless you got it in writing, tough, pal. But then the National Security Archive at George Washington University in 2019 posted that not only did they get it in writing, but they got it in writing from Bush and from Baker and from Thatcher and from Mitterrand and from what's his name and from all of them. The French president and the German chancellor, all of their defense ministers, they all swore to God they would not expand NATO east of Ukraine in writing. So then Peter Baker's piece this week says, Well, but they never got a treaty that said that. And they're just moving the goalposts. Because the answer is that the Americans broke their promise. Gorbachev said, we'll pull our troops out of Germany and we'll let you reunify Germany as long as you promise not to expand NATO eastward. And that's all they've done. Now, if you take it from the people who are responsible for this policy in the Clinton government, the W. Bush and Obama governments, and even the Trump governments, he added Macedonia and, well, Northern Macedonia and Montenegro to NATO as well. The idea is that we will have built up our power so big and so bad that no one will ever call our bluff. We can take our line that used to say, we will never let you invade Western Germany. If you invade Western Germany and, like, I don't know, Belgium and Denmark and France and Spain, we will go to war with you, Russia. That was the promise from 1946 through 89, 90, right? When the Cold War ended. Now we've moved that line 1,200 miles to the east and said, if you roll into Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia, or Poland, and possibly even Ukraine, you'll have a problem with us then. And again, the idea is that we'll have essentially united Europe in this military front. And then so no one will ever challenge that. You know, just like mutually assured destruction. Well, it's worked so far. Let's keep it this way forever. But the day that it fails, we're all dead. Omnicide. So maybe that's not the best policy going forward. You know, we outlaw chemical weapons. Seems like we could outlaw nukes. I don't know. People don't really talk about that. But that's the policy. And the problem with that is, of course, as Gareth Porter called his book about Vietnam, the perils of dominance. That just because that this is how they got into Vietnam, is they knew secretly that America was 100 times more powerful than Russia and China combined. So what are they going to do about it? We can do whatever we want. When the reality was, even though they were 100,000 times more powerful than Ho Chi Minh, he wouldn't give in. So all of their advantages meant nothing. All they did was get themselves bogged down in the big muddy where they didn't belong in the first place, right? And so this is the same kind of thing here. The great anti-war conservative army colonel, Douglas MacGregor, wrote a piece for the American Conservative magazine recently where he said, and you and I know about Robert Stinnett and Pearl Harbor, but anyway, on a little bit less thorough version of that history, he says, when FDR kept the fleet at Pearl Harbor, that was meant to be a deterrent. That was meant to be a signal to the Japanese that you better not mess with us. After our war games this year, we're staying halfway out instead of coming back to California. But in fact, it wasn't a deterrent. It was a provocation. And MacGregor said, it's the same thing now. We're telling the Russians in Ukraine and we're telling the Chinese in Taiwan that you better not anything or else you're going to have to tangle with us. But instead of deterring them, it's actually provocative and it's putting them in the situation that FDR put the Japanese in, that maybe they need to go ahead and do a first strike and take care of business now rather than wait and let the situation get worse. And MacGregor's point being that the people in DC, they like to talk a lot, but they don't know what they're doing. They could get us in real trouble here because, for example, Vladimir Putin has a red line in Ukraine. And there's a great WikiLeaks document. It's, in fact, our current head of the CIA is William Burns. And sometimes I screw his name up, Burns. He's in the WikiLeaks. And he met with Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister. And Lavrov told him, Niet means Niet. That's the title of the WikiLeaks. You can find it in the State Department cable. Niet means Niet. And it's Burns writing home to the State Department that, well, I just met with Sergei Lavrov and he made it very clear in very polite language that the Russian state will do anything to keep Ukraine out of NATO. Anything. So, and then it was not long after that that Putin himself said to an Italian diplomat that, you know, we could be in Kiev in 2 weeks. Mm. In other words, they are willing to risk war to prevent America from integrating Ukraine into the Western system, never mind the EU, but into the NATO military alliance. He's just not going to allow it. And the Americans are so arrogant that they can't just say that, yeah, you know what? We did kind of push our luck here. These very same people. I mean, the Biden government is the Obama government. These are the people who got us into this mess. I mean, Bush overthrew the government there in 2004. But then the pro-Russian guy got elected again after that. But the current crisis dates back to 2014. And yeah, I mean, it is. It's really dangerous. And you listen to like this guy, Stoltenberg, who's the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO right now. And he just talks all of this smack about all of Europe is prepared for war with Russia now to defend Ukrainian sovereignty. Really? I mean, first of all, that's just not true, right? The Germans and French are not going to war for Ukraine. You know, they might expect America to, but all of Europe is not united and ready for war. But the head of their military alliance likes saying that very loudly in front of microphones and cameras. That seems reckless. Who are these people? You know, it's just like, I don't know if you saw everybody's favorite libertarian, Jeffrey Tucker, tweeted about Sotomayor when she got the statistics so wrong in that Supreme Court debate about the children with COVID and whatever. And he says, see, at long last, we see that government is made up of just regular stupid people. You know, these are the people in charge of us. They're not any more qualified to create this sort of foreign policy than you and me, and probably quite a bit less, especially since of all the conflicts of interest that they have involved in it. So, you know, I don't know, man. I do think that Biden is old enough and cranky enough that he's going to mostly do what he wants. And that's going to, for the most part on this issue, be less worse than most of his cabinet is insisting on. But that only goes so far, you know. And they didn't really resolve anything here. You know, they should have at least made some significant agreement here. They did not.
Hey, folks, let me take just a quick minute away from my conversation with Scott to share a little story with you. Not long ago, on my email list, I shared a little graphic, and it was two cartoon people. And the first person says, I'm afraid of what 2022 might bring. And the second person says, I think it will bring flowers. And the first person says, why do you think that? And the second person replies, because I'm planting flowers. Folks, that is what we have to do right now, is to do what we can in our own lives to bring ourselves happiness. And a wonderful way to plant flowers for 2022 is with Skillshare, my sponsor for this episode. 2022 can be for you a year of new learning, growth, and connection through creativity with the online classes, thousands and thousands of them, that Skillshare offers in a wide variety of subject areas. Maybe things you never saw yourself doing, like photography or film or design or illustration or gardening or business, entrepreneurship, and marketing. And you don't have to have a lot of spare time to do it. Short lessons, hands-on projects, classes designed for real life. You can tap into that creativity you have inside and plant those flowers for 2022. I've been coaching both myself and my kids when it comes to marketing yourself in this new world. So Peggy Dean's class, Social Media for the Creative Entrepreneur, Exposure, Tips, and Pros and Cons, is the kind of class that's very helpful. So explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a 1 month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods. I was reading in Consortium News, I read something Scott Ritter wrote, and he was talking about the threat of sanctions on Russia in the midst of all this. And his view was that the Russians can withstand sanctions for longer than the Europeans can live without Russian energy. You think that's the case?
I think that probably is. I mean, I'm no expert on the energy resources of Europe right now, but I know that the Germans have worked very hard to build this Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And I do know that the Russians have been saying outright that, look, we're prepared for the worst. You guys want to kick us out of SWIFT. You guys want to completely kick us out of the European community entirely. Fine, we'll create our own SWIFT and we'll just ally that much closer with China in the East and do whatever we can there and figure it out. At the end of the day, they're petroleum exporters, so they don't have that big of an economy, but they'll find somebody to sell those hydrocarbons to, right? So I mean, just think about the catastrophe here. If you take for granted the American empire's prerogatives, you might wonder why they're doing this. You know, Donald Trump, for all the accusations of his treason and all of this nonsense, absolutely 0% of which was true. The real explanation for his willingness to tilt toward Russia, at least during the campaign, was, as he put it, well, I met with Henry Kissinger, and he agrees with me that we should tilt toward Russia to balance against China. Now, that's not my position. I think we should, well, never mind. We don't need a foreign policy at all. Let's just say that. But what do we have to gain from making an enemy out of the Russians? You know, on like a larger time scale, kicking them out of Europe, essentially, and pushing them toward Asian civilization overall. How do we gain from that? As you know, Tom, the last two times the Germans and the Russians fought, it was the worst thing that ever happened. So here the Germans and the Russians want to build a big pipeline and stay economically interdependent on each other and help keep the peace. And the Americans will do anything to try to ruin it. In fact, this is one good thing about Biden, is that he backed off the Obama and Trump era sanctions, which it was already a done deal anyway. I mean, they put sanctions on German firms that were building this pipeline. And then they just said, oh, well, screw you. We just go ahead anyway, and continued on. And they've essentially finished it now, I believe. And Biden essentially recognized that as a done deal and lifted those sanctions. But, you know, that's part of their threat, is that if the Russians do anything in Ukraine, the Americans will go to total economic war. Oh, one thing I meant to say earlier was that in 2014 and 15 was, you know, the war broke out in the aftermath of the coup in the east of the country because the Donbass region, Donetsk and Luhansk, refused to recognize the new coup junta. And then Kiev invaded, called it a war on terrorism, and invaded and started a horrible war that killed more than 10,000 people. And during that, the Russians did send special operations forces across to help the people of the Donbass keep Kiev out, but they never invaded. And we had stories, top of the fold, top headline, New York Times, front page, Russia invades Ukraine. Never even happened. Special operations forces, deniable clandestine forces only. And in February 2015, the Donbass held a plebiscite or referendum thingy where they voted to join the Russian Federation, and Putin told them no. Putin said, I don't want you. And he's got multiple reasons, by the way, for doing that. First of all, in the far east of the country where it's, you know, predominantly Russian speaking and all that, their demographics skew old and pensioner, and they're just expensive. It'd be an immediate net drain, the individual, you know, medical and social security type accounts and whatever for all those people be immediate negative on the Russian treasury. And then secondly, almost all their industry is old and decrepit and would need massive investments in order to become productive and profitable again. And also, right now they have kind of a nice 50-50 split between the Russian-speaking and pro-Russian-leaning half of Ukraine and so-called ethnic Ukrainians. I don't know if there's really a different ethnicity going on there at all, but that's how they call them, ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. And predominantly, I think it's more of just a nationality, but anyway, the predominantly Ukrainian speakers of the West, right now they kind of, you know, he's got this diluted mix. If he seizes the entire east of the country and integrates all of that into the Russian Federation, well, now the rump state of Ukraine is dominated by not just ethnic Ukrainians, but right-wing Ukrainian nationalists who could be much more of a problem without that balancing influence inside their own country. And so, you know, as I like to point out about the seizing of the Crimean Peninsula, after the Soviet Union fell, or as you know, but your audience may not know, the Crimean Peninsula in the Black Sea belonged to Russia since 1783, is when they stole it from the Turks and the Tatars there, back when we were still under the Articles of Confederation. So it belonged to them this whole time. So if New York State belongs to the USA, then the Crimean Peninsula belongs to Russia. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal was that Khrushchev, after Stalin died, needed the support of the Ukrainian Communist Party to help come to power. And so he gifted them with, you know, this edict from the General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, said that Crimea now belongs to Ukraine. At the time, it didn't really matter that much because everybody was answerable only to the Kremlin anyway. But then when the Soviet Union broke up, now 30 years ago, this last Christmas was the 30th anniversary of the final dissolution of the Soviet Union. And the red flag came down and the red, white, and blue went up. And then after that, Ukraine and Belarus and everybody got their independence. That was the very end of it. And the Ukrainians signed a deal. They gave up their nukes to Russia. And they promised that the Russians could keep their naval base at Sevastopol there on the Crimean Peninsula. And the Russians didn't have to pay a lease for it, essentially. And that deal held for 25 years until Obama and Biden overthrew the government of Ukraine for the second time in 10 years. And when the new junta came to power, the first thing they did was threaten to kick the Russians out of that naval base. And Putin said, I don't think so, and seized the thing in a coup de main, which, by the way, no one was killed. Not one person was shot and killed when the Russians seized the Crimean Peninsula. They just went outside and stood on street corners and said, this belongs to us now. And I saw the footage back then of them firing warning shots over the heads of some Ukrainian soldiers and telling them, you boys better turn around and head the other way. And they said, you know what? That's a good idea. And that was the end of that. So I'm not saying that's the greatest thing in the world or whatever. It was a direct consequence and reaction against American intervention in Ukraine there and the attempt to kick them out of their only all year round warm water port that is their direct access to the Mediterranean and the rest there. And as Brzezinski put it, if we take Ukraine and Crimea away from Russia, then they cease to even be a regional power. You know, this is the best way to stick it to them. And this is something, as long as I'm free associating here, people should look at Moon of Alabama. I know it sounds silly. The guy's not from Alabama.
Moon of Alabama has, whoever that is, has been great.
Oh, no, he's brilliant. So, I mean, the title of the blog sounds silly because it's taken from lyrics from an old song or something. I don't know. But the thing is, the guy's a German. And he's a brilliant analyst. His name is Bernard. I know his last name, but you're not supposed to.
Okay.
His name is Bernard. And he's a brilliant analyst of American foreign policy. For years and years, he has been. And he has this great thing where he reposted this study from the Rand Corporation about how can we stick it to Russia? And how, you know, we're not really enemies. We're just competitors. But here's some things that we could do to them. And it's all just as explicit as could be. You can read it right on the Rand website. We need to increase still, again, support for the rebels in Syria. We need to increase arms to Ukraine. We need to try to do a color-coded revolution and overthrow the government in Belarus. And we need to try to weaken the Russian position in the Central Asian stands and possibly lure them into over-expensive overextension. Does any of this sound familiar? And this is going on right now when we're supposed to be friends with these guys. We act like the Cold War never ended. The Rand Corporation says, listen, here's a step-by-step plan for everything we think we can get away with doing to the Russians right now. And then our government just implements it. And there it is. Check. And of course, you know, the color-coded revolution in Belarus failed, but they tried it last year. And, you know, of course, then we see what's pretty obviously an attempted color-coded revolution in Kazakhstan over the last couple of weeks, which, you know, thankfully has failed. That could have been much worse. And, you know, Blinken said, did you see this? The American Secretary of State said, yeah, once the Russians come, it can be very difficult to get them to leave. I can't even say it without laughing.
Yeah, I know. There's no, but you wonder, is it a question of they really have no self-awareness or are they just propagandists and they can't help themselves?
Yeah, or are we living in the Matrix and this is all for my entertainment, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know, maybe. It would explain a lot. should we move over to Kazakhstan just in the interest of time?
Yeah, let's do Kazakhstan.
All right, so there's unrest over there. As usual, the U.S. is finger-pointing and wagging its finger because anytime there's unrest, it's always there are wonderful lowercase d Democrats that we have to go in and support. And I was reading somewhere, let's see, where was this? Oh, I think this might also have been on Consortium. Look, people, Consortium News is great, but you should be reading antiwar.com first, all right? Get linked over to Consortium News. So don't do as I do, do as I say.
You'll find them in the viewpoint section at antiwar.com every week for sure.
Okay, good, good, good. Well, it was, I don't have it right at hand, but I was reading an article on this subject, and the author said, years ago, I spoke to a Kazakh official who kind of put it to me this way. He said, you have to understand that every sensible Kazakh has a map in his head. What that map shows is that Russia is there, and China is there, and Kazakhstan is in the middle, and America does not appear anywhere on that map.
Right.
But the thing is, that's where the Kazakh's going to have to adjust his map, because America is everywhere.
That's right. And in space, hovering over, you know, eye in the sky, looking down at 4K quality. So, yeah, now, I like that quote. You'll have to send me that, or I'll have to Google that up.
I'll get it to you.
So here's the thing. Yes, it's on the list, on the Rand Corporation list of things that we can do here. Just for people who are struggling to picture their very detailed map of Central Asia that they carry around in their head all the time, Kazakhstan is the big one. So there's Uzbekistan and obviously Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. But Uzbekistan is the big one, as Tom just said there, occupying this massive space, essentially, you know, just west of Outer Mongolia and taking up a massive amount of space between Russia and China. I read somewhere it's the longest, the border between Kazakhstan and Russia is the longest land border in the world. So I don't know if that's exactly true, but sounds right. Judging by my map, sure could be. So that's the context here is, you know, if Ukraine is Russia's Canada, Kazakhstan is Russia's Mexico, and America's down there screwing around. And, you know, not all the facts are in yet, but it's pretty obviously an American-backed coup there. You know, as Dan McAdams pointed out on my show, you could have the Turks involved working as cutouts. You could have other NATO countries involved. Poland, of course, played a big role in the attempted putsch in Belarus. So, you know, it's probably not just the Americans, but there's some strong indications of American involvement, including there were some anti-government protests in the middle of December, and the State Department put out a big, or I guess the embassy to Kazakhstan put out a thing essentially promoting it, right? Not warning people to stay away because there could be political unrest, but like, hey, everybody, turn out for the big protest on the 16th, this kind of thing. And I believe it was Bernard that had the stats that showed how many millions of dollars the National Endowment for Democracy has been pouring in to various so-called NGOs and civil society groups and so forth in the country. And I forgot, I'm sorry, who said this. It may have been Carl Gershman, who was up until very recently the head of the NED for like 25 years or 30 years or something, who said that their job is to do what the CIA used to do clandestinely, they do openly, essentially. You can see it going on right in front of your eyes. The pro-democracy groups aren't pro-democracy. They're pro-American foreign policy. They're there to represent American interests in other people's countries. And of course, as we've been discussing in Ukraine, if a democratically elected government is in their way, they'll support a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis to overthrow the thing. They don't care. They don't care about democracy at all and prove it constantly. And so, not that this is a democracy. It is a tyranny. I'm not exactly sure. I know that Nazarbayev, the previous dictator, was the dictator from before the end of the Soviet Union all the way through just a couple of years ago. And then apparently the guy who was in charge now was his hand-picked guy. As far as I know, they didn't even have an election. Maybe they did, but there's certainly not a bunch of healthy opposition parties in Kazakhstan. It is not a Western European democratic anything. So it's a tyranny. And then, of course, that becomes, just like most countries are, to some degree or another, and then that becomes the great excuse that, look, it's tyranny and somebody's got to do something about it.
Okay, so then what is the real motivation if it's not that?
To stick it to Russia, to control the Caspian Basin and make sure that all those hydrocarbons go south and east and west instead of north through Russia.
Okay,
before they get where they're going.
So it had to be something like that. And then, again, in this article I was reading, it says, the second motive lies in a desire to make trouble for China. One important part of China's Belt and Road Network is intended to run through Kazakhstan. It's invested heavily in Kazakhstan's infrastructure, created a free trade zone, etc.
Right. Yep.
And then there's an ethnic element potentially that could explode out of this too.
I'm not so sure about that. What do you have in mind there?
Well, because up to now, there's apparently a Russian minority in Kazakhstan, but up to now this hasn't been a problem. There's been, because the Kazakh regime has not made any real effort to aggress against them or make their lives difficult. And Putin, although he's a Russian state nationalist, is not an ethnic nationalist, right? I mean, he's not going around trying to stir up Russian minorities. But in this type of situation, isn't there always a possibility that if tensions rise, that peace that has existed might not persist?
Right. Well, and of course, this is why, and he's been quoted a few times, not lamenting the fall of communism and totalitarianism, but lamenting the fall of the Soviet Empire. And when he says it, he says over and over again exactly what he means by it is because they left all those ethnic Russians behind in all of these states where, hey, frankly, they were cleansing people and spreading, you know, ethnic Russians into other people's countries during the era of the Soviet Empire. But then that they got left behind. And so now the Russian state feels all this tension that they're kind of responsible for these people and their welfare, even though they're not in a literal sense. And then, you know, the American hawks, by the way, always say that, well, yeah, this is why Russia probably will want to invade the Baltic states, for example. But just like you're saying in this case, the Russian minorities in the Baltic states are not being persecuted and don't need to be rescued by armed force right now. So there's no reason to kind of drum up those tensions in that way. But there is a real possibility of long-term conflicts. You know, I believe that America is, and maybe there's the only place where we can pull this off, and I don't know if we can pull this off, but we're supposed to, where everybody's just an individual. And what we have in common is not our same ethnicity and even religious faith or any of that. It's a belief in liberty, a belief in freedom of religion, for example. But the rest of the world, to me, it's the curse of the old world, right? That everybody's divided all by ethnicities, but all the borders are in all the wrong places. So what are you going to do? Have everybody fight about it forever? Figure out how to sit down at a table and negotiate a way to do land swaps and move borders somehow between this and that? Forget anarcho-capitalism, but just how about keeping everybody on Earth from killing each other? And so many of the borders, especially in Central Asia and in Africa, were drawn by the Western European imperialists in the 19th century and so forth. And to deliberately divide and conquer people, or deliberately group different ethnicities and tribes together in order to keep them in tension so that they're easier to dominate and this kind of thing. So who can ever unwind all of that? I don't know. But certainly not the Americans,
right?
Well, screwing around and causing trouble, stirring things up there, you know?
Well, with Ukraine, we see, you know, they've had these talks about it, and we see what kinds of disastrous consequences could arise from a conflict there. Here, what would the U.S. do in this case? I mean, there is some suspicion, even though it might not be true in this case, that the U.S. was behind the unrest. But even if the U.S. protests innocence, nobody believes them because they do seem to be behind a lot of this stuff. But what really would be the practical consequence if the U.S. gets upset about this? I mean, wouldn't it just be something like in 1956 and 1968, they got upset about what the Soviets were doing, but when push came to shove, they didn't do anything about it?
Yeah. Well, and there should be an important lesson for all our so-called allies in the world out there, too, that the Americans talk a big game, but no, we will not come and rescue you, and we will not trade Houston for talent. You know, we're not going to go to war for Finland or for Kiev. And as even Biden himself said, he was asked point blank, if Russia invades Ukraine, are you going to put troops in there? And he says, no, we will not. Our obligation is to NATO countries, and Ukraine is not in NATO. Okay. Well, good. Let's keep it like that. It's crazy to think that we would be inviting Ukraine into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Just on the face of it, it's preposterous.
Yeah, that's true. Although this is also the guy, you know, who said he doesn't favor mandated vaccines, and, you know, the U.S. regime, you know, we all know what they told Saddam. You know,
he said he was going to end the war in Yemen, and he didn't. So,
Or I don't even have to go as far back as Saddam, but, you know, look, if you have some kind of weirdo dispute with Kuwait, that's, you know, that's your issue.
Yeah.
And then,
well,
bang.
Right. Right. Yeah. And he always has been terrible. I am trying to look at it. Like, I think there are a couple examples, like in Afghanistan, where the guy has been wrong about everything his whole life to the point where he's got nothing left to do but call some correct shots. I don't know. Could be worse. I mean, honestly, I don't think Trump would have got out of Afghanistan. It was his deal, but he always rolled over whenever the military told him to roll
over. Yeah, that's right. Like, he tried to do some things, and then he wound up just with his tail between his legs. I think it's
from the very beginning.
In part because he so romanticized the military. So how does he actually stand up and defy the top brass after he—
Right. I mean, he would have had to, and here's the counterfactual right here. If he really had his act together and his head right about what his agenda was, and if he really, really meant it, he would have never been impressed with the medals on James Mattis's chest. He would have hired Douglas MacGregor, who is the hero of Iraq War I's big tank battle, who was McMaster's former commanding officer, who's considered one of the most brilliant military officers in the current American era. And that guy from the American Conservative Magazine and the Tucker Carlson Show, that guy could have stood at Trump's right flank and said to the American people and the American foreign policy establishment, yes, we are coming home and it's okay. He's the right-wing tough guy, the most macho and most brilliant guy in the room. And he assures us that, yes, it's time to come home now. We don't need to be a world empire anymore. As he told me, that our only competitor really in the world is China. And that's just economically from his point of view. But we have no enemies at all. Neither Russia or China or any other state on this planet is the enemy of the United States of America. And we should not be changing that with our aggressive foreign policy the way we're doing. If Trump had hired him and stuck with him, then we would be living in a different world right now. But unfortunately, he went, wow, James Mattis, you remind me of George C. Scott in that one movie about Patton. Yeah, so that was the end of that. But anyway, let me say one more thing here because I know we're short on time. But I wanted to point out two things here real quick, both from the New York Times. The first thing is now a word from X. It's by Thomas Friedman, 1998. And he's quoting George Kennan, who was one of the State Department weenies who originated the containment policy against the Soviet Union, inaugurated it really with his essay in Foreign Affairs on the sources of Soviet conduct by X. Okay. It was written anonymously at the time because he was still in government. So Friedman interviews him in 1998, and the guy is screaming and yelling and stamping his feet. And, you know, you can read it, the tone of voice that he's hollering at Tom Friedman in. That NATO expansion is the stupidest, dumbest, most horrible, worst thing in the whole world. Why would we do this? These stupid senators, they're not even interested in foreign policy. They don't even know. They just want some Polish votes in Illinois and this kind of crap. But they don't realize what they're doing. These are the men who overthrew the communists for us. These are the world's greatest heroes. They destroyed the Soviet Union. But we're treating them like they're still the bad guys, that they're the Soviets. And we say, our hawks, our NATO expansion hawks, say that this isn't about Russia. We're not threatening Russia. We're not mad at Russia. Hell, we'll bring Russia into our NATO-Russia council. And maybe we'll even bring Russia into NATO. And this is why I was a one world order, New World Order kook in the 1990s, is because that's what I thought the New World Order really meant. We're going to bring Russia into NATO, be the one white army of the North at war against the Islamic South Asia, this kind of thing. Although, of course, that's not how it played out. Instead, how it played out was, as Kennan predicted, that the Americans, in the name of saying that this has nothing to do with threatening Russia, will encircle Russia and will encroach so close to Russia that the Russians react. And then when the Russians react, the very same people who are telling us now that it's perfectly fine will say, see, the Russians are aggressive. And that's why we have to do this, is to defend Europe from them. And as he put it, I believe the direct quote is, but that's just not right. And this is in 1998, telling us our present, okay? And then here's the other thing that I really like. Strobe Talbott, who was Bill Clinton's roommate at Oxford when he's a Rhodes Scholar, I think he was his national security advisor. He tried to be CIA director, but was shot down for that, if I remember the 90s well. But he was national security advisor, and he was the guy who pushed NATO expansion more than any other person. And in fact, James Carden quotes from his memoir that Bill Clinton said to him, hey, aren't you George Kennan's protege? And doesn't Kennan hate this? Oh, I meant to say too, Tom, Paul Nitza and Robert McNamara and Robert Gates and numerous hawks at the time agreed. Former Soviet hawks, never mind Pat Buchanan and his guys. But Nitza and McNamara even said that this is crazy, we shouldn't be doing this. And Clinton said to Talbott, doesn't George Kennan, aren't you his protege and isn't he against this? And Talbott says, oh, he always just hated NATO anyway, and dismisses it. Okay, but now in the year 2018, this reporter from the New York Times Magazine goes and talks to Talbott. And this, to me, gets right to the heart of one aspect of the ideology of American empire here. And this is, you know, a realist so-called talking, or maybe more of like a liberal interventionist, but he's not a neoconservative. He's a Bill Clintonite, right? He's Bill Clinton's roommate. He's a center-left, you know, essentially a right-wing Democrat, moderate type. And so here he explains, he says, pardon his syntax here. If the leadership of a country has any view but the following, it's not going to be the leadership of that country for very long. And that is, we do what we can in our own interest. And then it says here, but the NATO question, Talbott admitted, was complicated. Quote, Should we have had a higher, wiser concept of our real interests that would require us to hold back on what many people would say is our own current interest? In other words, if you're the national security advisor for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and you're saying, ooh, we could expand our power and influence by integrating more Eastern European countries into NATO, ooh, and we can make a bunch of money selling Lockheed equipment to them, et cetera, like that. That's in our interest. We have to do that. And if you have a job as national security advisor and you don't exploit every opportunity to do everything you can at somebody else's expense, then you're not going to be the leadership of a country very long. You have to do it. But then now, 20 years later, 25 years later, Tom, he says, should we have thought about maybe larger, longer-term consequences that might erase all that we thought that we had gained? Like maybe we could provoke a nuclear war with Russia and lose all of our lives and our entire civilization? Should we have had a higher, wiser concept of our real interests? He says. And then the answer is, yeah. And the answer is, even me, even your lowly cab-driving podcast guest, you know, at the time, in 1997, 98, 99, this was the discussion me and my passengers were having all the time. That you think you can get away with whatever you want, but look at what you're giving away. Look at the danger that you're putting us in. America thinks under Bill Clinton, we can just bomb Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia for a decade straight. Yeah, you can, but not without getting your towers knocked down. You can't.
Yeah.
And these people, they just think they can do whatever they want. And I just love it the way, you know, the cliche, out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
Like, well, geez, you know, my job is to be an evil, cynical, criminal exploiter of mankind. But, should I sometimes think harder about what the consequences might be? Jeez, I guess maybe. In hindsight, he says 20 years later, after getting us into this, you know, essentially nuclear crisis here.
Well, one last thing I'll just say. This is one of the reasons I just cannot ever bring myself to use the expression U.S. interests. And
right.
Anytime I see somebody from a think tank, especially one saying they're libertarian or, of course, conservative, and they use the term U.S. interest, I just know they're just part of the lizard people. That's not the way. You should not be using this type of regime language.
That's right.
Because U.S. interest never, ever, ever means the interests of Scott Horton or Tom Woods, ever.
Right. It means the interests of some companies at the expense always of the rest of us. As Smedley Butler said, we should only ever fight in defense of our lives, our liberty, our Bill of Rights, period.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Listen, everybody. Remember what Scott Horton does here. In addition to all the things I told you about at the very beginning, he keeps himself informed about everything so that we can bring him on and get a nice briefing like this. And that's why I support Scott. And you know, not everybody's in a position to financially support other people, especially right now. I totally understand that. So Scott also appreciates your sharing his episodes and the moral support. But for those of you who are in a position to help out, remember how we say all the time that in a libertarian society, people would voluntarily support. Well, of course, in a libertarian society, we wouldn't have the U.S. Military regime and the deep state and the DOD and everything else to contend with. But the point is, the idea is that we would voluntarily support people doing good work. Well, why not do that now when we need it even more? We need Scott's work even more now than we would in a libertarian society. We need it now. So scotthorton.org, you can go and support him, as I do every month, because the work he does is very important. Scott, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate that.
All right, folks. Remember, as we go into the weekend, make sure you head over to tomwoodsannouncement.com and sign up to be notified February 1st, 9 o'clock a.m., 2022, about my announcement. It's very important. It's the most valuable thing I can do for the good folks out there who listen to the Tom Woods Show, but well beyond people who listen to the Tom Woods Show. Folks like you and me who live under a regime that despises us, what course of action should we take? That's going to be my announcement. So, tomwoodsannouncement.com, the announcement will not be made on the podcast, and it'll be obvious why that's the case. It's too time sensitive. By the time people hear it on the podcast, it will have vanished. So, you got to be there. February 1st, 9 a.m. If you get on the list, you will be notified immediately. When it hits 9 o'clock, you'll be notified and you'll know what it's all about. So please do this. You're going to be happy you did. TomWoodsAnnouncement.com. I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.